let's probably continue with the view that we had last time, where we were standing at to compute whether our attribute system can have circles or not. And let's continue with how to come up with evaluation strategies for our attribute systems. So what are possible ways to come up with evaluation strategies? Well, of course, there's always the opportunity to just let the user define some kind of evaluation order. Then you can, of course, also try to do the whole system automatically. This works particularly well for situations where you can, for example, just join together all the dependency summaries, the global dependencies that we have already pre-computed. And if there is just a linear order between all the dependencies, well, you have a clear way to say which of the attributes has to absolutely come first in evaluation and which one can be done later on. You can also see which one have dependencies at all and might be computed in the same pass. So the idea would be to come up with passes of your passes in your evaluation. In the case that there is a clear order between the different attributes and in the attribute dependencies, and if there is, you can actually just start with the one that that everything depends on, and then successively compute all the others. And while performing one of these passes, you get for each of the local nodes, you get the actual actions that you have to do at these nodes out of the local dependencies between the attributes. So yeah, you would always try to evaluate one of these nodes with a goal to evaluate one of the attributes, and then follow the local functions of evaluation. Yeah, the third possibility would be to come up with an automatic strategy for arbitrary attribute systems, but to do it kind of the other way around, to pre-specify the strategy that we want to use and only allow actual attribute systems that do not create any circles with the predefined strategy. That's also a valid approach to the whole system, and I think we'll see an example later on for the whole thing. Yeah, for automatic strategies, what can you do in these cases? Well, for example, what you can do is you can perform demand-driven evaluation. So this is an approach that actually works best in cases where you are interested in one particular attribute only. And what you would do there is then start in exactly the node and with exactly the attribute that you're actually interested in, and then evaluate the different dependent attributes by need if they are not yet evaluated. So you have a notion of whether an attribute is already evaluated or has yet to be evaluated. And in case that they are not yet evaluated, you have to compute evaluation of these attributes recursively. So you would kind of keep a stack of or some kind of data structure of still to be attributed, still to be evaluated attributes, where you push new ones on top, which you have to kind of close before you can finally evaluate the ones further on the bottom. And yeah, what these kinds of algorithms actually do is that they visit the nodes of the syntax tree on demand. So What they do is that depending on the way that your attribute equations are actually structured, they will consider the flow through such a syntax tree according to the way to the order in which these attributes are occurring, and they do not consider any way of locality or something. So they will it may be that your evaluator will traverse the tree several times and try to navigate through all the inner edges several times, depending on how the different or the particular attribute equations are actually specified and which of the attributes are now to be evaluated. So that is something that creates a little bit of an overhead, especially in some certain conditions we're going to talk about later on. What you can also do is try to perform evaluation in certain passes. And with such a pass, you would try to do as much work as possible with a certain strategy that you're going through your system, and you would try to choose the strategy with which you can evaluate the most of your attributes for your system, and then go through the system once again and try to once again evaluate even more attributes. And it's with that you would try to minimize the number of visits to each of the nodes. And the thing is that you would try to fit the evaluations in the kind of the way that you would fit them into the path through your tree that actually fits the way that these attributes are evaluated. So for each of these passes, you would have to pre-compute a strategy how to visit the nodes together with taking the actions that from the local attribute equations that actually fit the each of these runs through your syntax tree. When you think back at the start example where we had the algorithm how to compute the first, next, last, and empty attributes on your on the syntax tree of regular expressions, you can if you would have to assign passes to certain attribute evaluations, you would, for example, start with the evaluation of the empty attribute, because that is something that's just not depending on anything else, which would impose a certain strategy on the evaluation of the whole tree, which would mean that for the empty attribute you would have to go bottom up through your whole tree, which is a depth first I think it's post order visit through your tree, and then you would have to check which of the other attributes that are solely dependent on on the evaluation of the empty attribute, which of them could be fitted into the same run, which would be compatible with depth first post order traversal, and turns out that there actually is one. And it is, I think it's first. So you would combine the first evaluation together with the empty evaluation and do them in one pass, which goes bottom up. And then there's only one attribute left. There's two runs left. There's last and next. And I think last is dependent on next, so you would have to do next. And for this one, you would have to go top down. So this is a different strategy. So you have to start a new pass anyway. So in the second pass, you would do the the top-down run with the evaluation of next, and then you can finish with another bottom-up run of last. But probably you can integrate the bottom-up run while passing back up from your top-down run. So there's probably chances that you can fit them in just two phases. But yeah, that's a little bit of implementation fiddling. So for the demand-driven evaluation, you can also try to achieve the computation of these next attributes as a demand-driven evaluation, just for an example to just see how that would work. So, for example, if you would be interested in the evaluation of the next attribute for leaves A2 and A3, and maybe also B4, so this would be these and this one. So we can just try to see what would have to be done for that. So if we just start with the red ones first, for didactical purposes, these are here for the alternative operator. You have the next attribute depending on just the parent's attribute. So by need, you would have to evaluate the parent's next attribute for the next of the parent in case of for the next of the right child in case of concatenation operator. You would have to once again evaluate the parent's attribute, and as this is once again the concatenation, you only have to evaluate this one, and that's the constant. So you would get a dependency chain of this one, which is also the chain in which such a demand-driven evaluation would go through the whole attribute system and compute its values. So instead of having to compute all the attributes for this large part here, you only would have to go one kind of chain up to the bottom, up to the top of the syntax tree. There's also, of course, a little bit more complicated situations. For example, if you have, if you're interested in the next attribute for the for this terminal symbol here, well, for this terminal node, for this leaf, then you would, in this case, you have to evaluate this one, which then has a whole lot of different attributes on which we are dependent. So we are interested in the first symbol of the second branch. So we are interested in first of this one. We are interested in empty of the second one, this one, and also on we are interested in next of the parent. So we this is this one. This is already evaluated in the last pass. So if you have a system that just caches all the already evaluated attributes, we can benefit from that. In any other way, would have to go back up again for this one. So the algorithm would then have to, in order to evaluate the next this next attribute, there are still things to do because we have to at first compute first for the right sibling and also empty for the right sibling. But these, once again, have a whole lot of dependencies going on. So there's a lot of recursive calls to the demand-driven evaluator here. So in the end, we will end up with a whole lot of calls to the demand-driven evaluation back there. But still, you'll notice that the whole left part of the attributed syntax tree didn't have to be touched at all. So, and that's already quite the computation that you don't need to do here for if you're only interested in this part. But Well, as you have noticed, I said if you're only interested in that specific attribute, and that is the whole kind of the whole backside of the story. Demand-driven evaluation is something that's really only from it is a thing that you only benefit from if you're only interested in specific locations in your syntax tree where you're interested for information. If you're interested in the first set the first attribute for all your nodes, then well, you will have to evaluate all of them anyway, so you won't save any computations. Instead, you have to keep track of whether you have evaluated a certain attribute already, and you have to deal with the non-local evaluation flow through your tree where you visit certain nodes several times and such. And this is something that actually generates overhead in your computation that you would like to get rid of. So demand-driven evaluation is a possibility, which is a quite elegant one because it's just a recursive recursively called local evaluation, what you do there, and the rest that you have to do is whether you just have to check whether something is already evaluated or not. However, it generates overhead for you in cases where you need to have all the attributes anyway. So, what is also quite tedious is whenever you try to debug such an algorithm, well, you have to deal with all the jumps between the different nodes. You have to deal with keeping track of the set of already evaluated attributes and all such. And this is something that is we have to look at a lot of places at the same time, which can be quite bothersome. So, yeah, it's difficult to debug, which is well, at least a downside for developing such an algorithm. The other thing is that the computation of all the attributes is often just cheaper because just it doesn't have to jump around a lot and doesn't have so much maintenance overhead. So, yeah, in most cases you have to compute them all anyway. Yeah, so the thing that is done in practice in most cases is the evaluation in passes. So we have already talked about that. We would have to consider the global dependencies between the right-hand side symbols of a certain production variant for that. And if you just from that, you can get the sequence in which you have to evaluate your attributes, and for everything else, you have to look at your local attribute equalities in order to equations in order to do the actual computations. And anyway, what you will come up with is several choices for each of the passes, because you can combine several. You can have different combinations of which of the attributes you want to evaluate first. So there's situations where you have two mutually exclusive choices for which of the other attributes you want to integrate into your actual pass at the moment, and in order to decide which of them is more beneficial, you end up with an optimization problem in a problem space which consists of the different combinations that you can do for each of the attributes, which is something that is in itself already quite a hard problem, but that's something that we don't want to touch here. You have other lectures which deal with that. For our example with the regular expressions we have already talked about, that we can join the empty and the first computation into one pass, and we have to perform the next pass in another way. So, yeah, something which is found quite often in practical systems is the necessity of a state of some way. For example, imagine that you want to perform a numbering of the leaves in your tree with just the help of something like these attribute grammars. Do you have any ideas how you would do that? You can approach, it's not the solution, just helper. So you can try to approach the whole thing in a kind of, in a similar way like you do with recursive programming. You can try to keep the thing that you would do in a parameter normally is something that you would do in an attribute. And the call is already something like a depth first search through your problem space, so to say. So the two algorithm types are a little bit related, so that probably helps you a little bit in thinking how you would do that.
So the idea is that we implement states just to mark if we are visited or not, or no?
Yeah, states is something that it comes from a certain necessity in there, because, well, if you try to perform this numbering of leaves, you will, the choices that you have are these kind of attribute dependencies, and there's, for example, if you perform try to do that with one attribute, through which you would, for example, try to pass the current number which you would give for the next leaf that you encounter. You run into situations where you would pass this number down there, and for example this number down there in a kind of inherited way, and pass it over here. But if you go over here, you would kind of carry on with the information that you found here. But in the same way, you would have to kind of bring the information back up to this point here. So that is something that's probably a little bit difficult to model with just one attribute. You would, in general, what you would probably like to do is have some kind of context or some kind of state in your evaluator which goes down and keeps track of the maximum number that you have already given to the leaves that you have visited so far. Because, well, if we do that, well, this way, we would say that so far we have not found any of the leaves, so we have to come up with ways to compute this number for these two parts, and for these we'd say, well, there's still zero, and you see, you will definitely visit some nodes when you further pursue this branch over here, but you had to come up with a certain way to evaluate this one already. And it just doesn't work with use the value for n for this one for the computation of the right branch also, because, well, it still needs to descend. So it has not actually reached the right value yet. And that is something which is kind of circumvented with a little trick. The idea is to not just use one attribute for this purpose, but to encode this feature that you have to deal with a certain kind of state by using several attributes. One for descending and one for coming back up, for example. So in this way, you could, in case that you have found one of these other leaves, you would then manipulate your other attribute, which you use for going back up, in order to carry the increased number, and then to use this one in order to go back up there, increase it once again, and carry it over there. So you would kind of use this pair of states in order to have one variable for the flow that is carrying the inherited character of your information, and the other attribute would kind of represent your synthesized character of your attribute. So this is a kind of common pattern for these attribute systems. So for certain attributes, we would use help attributes, which for one would be used before we actually perform the visitation of the whole subtree, which we would call the pre-visit or pre, and the other one would be the post-visit attribute, which we for short would just call post. And yeah, with this we can quite easily perform this numbering of leaves. We can for the root node, we will have to just store the or to just initialize the whole attribute system with a constant, which is, well, we have not had any contacts with any leaves just at the root right now. So for the pre-visitation of its subtree, we just say so far we had zero occurrences of leaves. The pre-visitation value of numbering of the right child would be is it actually the pre of zero? I'm not so sure whether that is actually correct. I think the previous, well, we would actually see. Well, the kind of idea that is behind that would be to go down with this number zero through the left through these pre-variables in an inherited way. You would at one point reach the leaf, in which you would just go over from the pre-visit to the post value, and we would just use the increased value of that, which is something that you can see here in the attribute system. Here you would, for the post value, you would take the pre-value plus one, because you have in this moment actually visited leaf. So that when you go back up through the nodes, the value of the first child, the first the post attribute of the left child is then going into the pre attribute of the second child, where it is once again propagated back down, then going in at one point into a situation where we increase it and pass the increased value back up through the post value, where here, through post two, the whole system is then the whole count of all the leaves of the subtree is then flowing into the post count of the whole node. So then, let's just check whether the whole system then is correct as it is for root. Well, this is probably quite correct. So the pre-value for the left child is the pre-value for the root. Yeah, so that propagates down. And if you come up back from the from the first child. With post, you, yeah, think, well, might be that it has kind of that structure in mind for the root node, but yeah, but like that, it's probably not correct. Well, what actually would have to happen is kind of a short circuit like this one, where the post value of the left child is taken as a pre-value of the right child. Well, yeah. So probably that's a structure like this one that is assumed for the root. You want to?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it. The root always assumes it just as one child. In this case, and all nodes have two childs.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, I'm a little bit confused with that grammar also. So, yeah, I would guess that because it never talks about any second index, that it just assumes that there is no second child. So, yeah, but in general, I would say that the right way to do that would be this one. Yeah. Yeah, bummer. So that's a little bit too generically specified without saying what the actual structure of the tree looks like. Yeah. Anyway, you get the idea. You have different attributes for one character of the information and one for the other, and you use both in one go in order to produce a certain type of information. Yeah. So if you always do your constructions of your attributes in this way, then well, there will never be any connection of incoming flow with flow that comes back up in this way, because there's never any connection that goes this way. So there, if you perform your strongly acyclic grammar test on these kinds of attribute systems that are designed with that pattern, you will never get any cycles in your dependencies. So this is something where you can actually find strategies to evaluate the whole system, and actually, it's something that you can evaluate in a very special way, because well, what you have to do in each of these subtrees is you have to at first compute the first child in dependent on just the parent. And you have to compute an attribute for the second child, depending on an attribute of the first child. And then, when you are done with the whole system, you have to just compute an attribute of the parent depending on an attribute of the right child. In this way, so if you go through the whole system with a depth-first search, you can, on the way, at first, compute this or this attribute equation, and you can do recursively your other evaluation. Then, if you go back up here in order to evaluate the second or to go through the second subtree of your evaluation, you can, alongside, compute the dependency of the two children's attributes, and then if you have evaluated everything of your subtree, you can then go back up and perform the last evaluation that is necessary, and such that in one go you have computed everything that you need for your attribute system. So this is a kind of special way of performing your attribute evaluation, or to specify your attribute systems. The most versatile thing about that is that it can be evaluated in a single depth-first traversal. And we have a special name for this way of specifying our attribute dependencies, and that is that we call our systems L-attributed. Why L? Well, it's probably kind of related to the way in which you can specify your attribute dependencies. For example, if you want to compute this attribute, all you can use is information that comes from here, which is roughly an L. So, that's kind of the intuitive way to remember how we call such a system. So that's L attributation. And these are quite common in practice. Well, first of all, probably the formal definition, but that's just tampering with the indices. So a system is L attributed if for each of, if you look at local definitions of our attribute equations, and we number the right-hand side symbols of our productions from 1 to n, then for if we look at a certain attribute that belongs to right-hand side symbol j, then if we only use the attributes that belong to symbols that have a lower index. So for j, if you look at 1 to j minus 1, 1 to j minus 1, or the parent, if we only specify our equations in that way, then we have an L-attributed system.
Okay.
Yeah, this is particularly useful because these kind of L-attributed systems, what we said was that they could be evaluated with just one depth first search, which would be handy because what your parser actually does is such a depth-first search through your derivation tree. So at least with top-down parsing, you could evaluate these L-attributed systems on the fly while you were still parsing. So you would already have a lot of the information necessary, and you would not have to run over the whole syntax tree once again. So that is why these L-attributed systems were of such strong interest, and maybe still today for new parsing systems. That is important if you never try to actually do the construction of the whole syntax tree. You have systems like that for years out there, which is just pocket calculators, which perform a lot of the computations already on the go without ever trying to actually construct the syntax tree. These L-attributed grammars are the most typical example for the case which we have mentioned before, where we would fix a kind of evaluation strategy by just saying, well, we want to use a depth-first search with these pre- and post attributes. And, we would only... we would only try to treat attribute systems that actually fit in the description, meaning that the attribute equations would only depend on attributes of symbols of the lower rank. Okay. In practical applications, there's a lot of analysis on the syntax tree that are related to program languages that are actually quite useful. So symbol tables and checking types and also code generation. I don't know how many of you are also sitting in virtual machines at the same time? So you might have already seen the way that code generation was specified in virtual machines, where there's just a kind of local generation schemes for certain subtrees of your of your syntax tree, and yeah, that is something that can also be done with such an L-attributed system, where you can just gather certain parts of generated syntax in a certain attribute and then piece it together with your local code generation functions. And there would be some kind of context variables passed down through the whole system where you have these symbol tables and environments and whatnot you use for your code generation functions. So, yeah, that's something which you could do with such an L-attributed grammar. Yeah. These systems in practice would in most cases kind of annotate the syntax trees with additional information that can be afterwards used for any purpose that you might want to. In most cases you would either try to optimize the structures of your intermediate representation or generate some kind of code at some place. In practical systems what you in most cases get is that in the parser callbacks, where you get callbacks for each of the reductions, you in most cases you would generate or replicate the structure of your input program in some way. So what you get for a syntax tree is an object structure where each of the objects has for type the something that corresponds to a syntactical element. So you already have for certain nodes already a certain typization for which you can use to implement these attribute systems already. And for each of these typed objects, you can store the attributes that they are associated with as just, well, attributes or properties of your object. And with one of these runs, you can then compute the contents for these properties. Yeah, so let's have a look at how you could do something like that in practice. So imagine that for our regular expressions, we have introduced a type for representing all the nodes that might actually occur in a regular expression syntax tree. So we have introduced the class regex for regular expressions, and what all of them would have to get would have to be able to accept would be a certain type of visitor, meaning some entity that runs through the whole structure and visits all the components of such a regular expression. So for that, we would introduce this visitor type. And this visitor type, in our cases, would be, for example, some interface, which would offer callback signatures, which you could then override in order to implement your attribute equations. And the concrete classes that in the end make up the whole syntax tree would then have to implement the code that actually calls these callbacks in the end. So for example, in our case, you would have the OR sub-expression, which would be represented with a node in the syntax tree. And we would, in this case, implement our accept routine in a way that it would call the pre-visit method of our visitor with our particular currently visited object as parameter, and then perform the descent down to our left child. Then if we come back up, we would visit some kind of intermediate visit method with this inter thing, again giving our currently visited element as a parameter, and then would descend through our right child node. And when we come back up, we would visit we call the visitor's post method with our current object. So that would be the idea how you could kind of implement this recursive descent or this depth first search through the regular expression syntax tree once and have only the callbacks to be implemented later on. And you could then try, for example, to implement this leaf numbering with a concrete visitor. And yeah, what you would do is you would just you need some way of storing the actual counter. So what I in this case did was introduce some map from some regular expression object to the actual integer variable that has the counter. There's several possibilities how to do that. You can also directly store these pre or post attributes just as attributes or properties within your concrete syntax tree class, but several ways of doing that actually. Yeah, okay. So I think you will have the joy of implementing a few of these visitors yourself on the tutorial sheets. But the general idea, I hope, is kind of similar to the one that I have chosen here. But of course, there's a lot of design space for you because it's just not one correct solution for that. But in general, the idea would be to have kind of generalized interface, which would offer you callback signatures, which you can then fill with life for yourself. And depending on the actual task that you have to solve, this would in detail work a little bit different to the things that you've seen here. But in general, you would have one depth-first search through your system implemented in these recursive accept calls and use the visit calls in order to specify your attribute equations. Okay, so is there any questions still to attribute systems? Okay, so we might then go one step further and talk about one of the typical applications of these attribute systems, which is now more closely related to what a specific topic in semantic analysis would be. This is symbol tables. So let's have a look at what the whole problem with syntax table is. So let's consider a flowing code piece, let it be Java or something else that has, I'm not really sure that this is really Java. It's probably more of a kind of special case of C dialect where you can have inner method declarations. So yeah, that's not Java. It's probably something like C. But yeah, the main point is that here in this example, you have a situation which occurs in many high-level languages, which is that you have certain areas. In this case, we call them a body. In this body of the function foo, we have a declaration or a definition of a local variable a. And later on, there is an inner body, in this case of the function bar, which has another definition of a variable. And the thing is that these definitions are important for translating these programs, because what you specify when you perform such a definition is is for once that you introduce the compiler to the fact that a certain identifier is now used as a variable name, and this is not just a generic variable, because for variables you can specify types. So you need to have a certain amount of space somewhere, and at the same time you don't want to waste space, so you want to make the space as tight as possible. So if you introduce a variable of type int, you will want to use just the amount that an int actually uses in memory. And as soon as you don't need this variable anymore, so for example at the end of the program where A is used last time and is not used anymore afterwards, you will want to discard the memory that you have used so far for the whole thing. So that is kind of important for the use of such a variable, that you have a declaration or definition somewhere. And at the same time, you want to have features like the ones that you see here, where we have another declaration which coincidentally uses the same name, probably because it has been copied from somewhere else or anything. But anyway, you still want this small piece of software to be, this small piece of code to be consistent with the most recent declaration of your variable. So in this case, you want this A to be associated with this definition, and also this A with this definition instead of the definition from above. So you call this as a kind of a situation where one identifier shadows the other one. So, yeah. Anyway, whenever you encounter such a variable name now, what you're interested in is actually the most recent declaration that has that is in your actual scope. So for this A, you would have you would be interested in this definition, because this is giving you the actual type and probably also some kind of handle into the memory where you store the data that is associated with this identifier. So what you want to have for each of the occurrences of an identifier is its binding, because each of these is bound to its most recent definition. Yeah. For example, we have two definitions in here of variable A. There is the scope of int A, which goes along the whole area here, so it's this here, and we have another scope of the other A, which is this double A here, which talks about this double here, and both of the scopes kind of overlap. So what is done is that one A shadows the other one. And as you see, this is something that is for beginners or quite difficult to understand. Things that are difficult for beginners are, in most cases, also kind of difficult to administer from the kind of compiler's point of view. So, how could you do such a administration of identifiers, scopes, and bindings? Well, there's even more complicated things if you consider object-oriented systems, where you have, for example, also these special modifiers that talk about the visibility of certain object components. And yeah, there can be quite difficult things to manage. For example, there's what do you have in these examples? Let's start with this this one here. Well, this private will tell you that the set will have a scope that is private to class foo, which means that only within the boundaries of the class's body, Z will actually be visible, and nowhere else. Then, what else do we have? We have, for example, Y. Y is something that's protected. And, well, what does that mean? Well, it's probably also mentioned over there. Well, Y is something that is actually visible to subclasses and anyway, you still have to consider situations that we had before. There's the concept of shadowing. So if you introduce such an Y in your child class, then this will actually shadow your original definition. Yeah, what else is there? There's the subclass visibility, that is the one that will apply when there is actually no specifier here, for what reason ever. So in this case, what will actually happen is that if you want to actually access this X from a subclass, that only works if you have your subclass in the same package. So, that's certainly a little bit confusing for beginners. And then there's the public declaration. Do we have? We have one here. So these two names for our method B are visible from the whole world, so it's not restricted to any certain things like packages or subclasses or anything. Okay, but in case of identity, all these things we talk about is about identities between certain identifiers. There's still more to consider, because in these cases, using the same name does not automatically mean that, that these two things are actually identical. In our case, for example, we have a situation that we call overloading, which is a thing in Java where you use the same name for a method, but you can actually use a different number of parameters, and if you do so, then you end up with two methods that are actually being considered as different. So for Java, also the complete signature of your method is something that you have to take into account when you talk about identity between identifiers. Okay, and even more, if you have methods of the same of the same signature, then you can have something which is called the dynamic resolution of or the dynamic dispatching of function calls. That is something that looks like this. You have two classes, foo and bar, which is a special version of foo, and both of them offer an identifier for a function name foo, and they have the same signature, they have the same parameters, but they are implemented differently. And you can have now situations like the following, where you store a reference to an object of type foo, which may be depending on some outside condition, either the parent class of the parent class foo or the child class bar. And now what you can do is you can have a method call which is statically checked to be valid, and is checked with the static type of X. So X has the static type foo, so it will be checked against the signature, and as the signature exists, the compiler will translate the whole thing. Although the compiler will not be exactly sure on which of the two implementations will actually be called in the end. That is something that is determined at runtime or dynamically, and it will be depending on the condition B here. And in one case, we will see the first implementation being called, and the other whenever B is false, we will see the second implementation called. So that is additional complications taking place here. However, this is something that is performed at runtime and has a lot of name lookups and or virtual tables and all that involved. That is something that we won't see too much in this lecture, but I would, if you're really interested in that stuff, I would say just pay programming languages in winter semester a visit, where there we will have the whole topic more extensively, so more intensively. So, yeah, I don't want to talk too much about this kind of behavior here. Anyway, if you want to find out for an identifier that you encounter somewhere in your syntax tree, what kind of memory access you have to do in order to deal with that occurrence, well, you will have to access somehow its information about its definition or declaration. So there's what you would like to have is have a way for at a certain point to directly read which declaration this or which definition this belongs to. And the idea how to perform that in compilers is that you would, well, in most cases, first of all, you would get rid of the redundancy and get rid of the strings that are actually used for these variables and replace them with a unique name, and this name would be only the same if the variable would really be the same as at another position. So you would get rid of non-unique naming. And also what you would like to do is to link each usage of the variable directly to the declaration of that variable. Yeah, and how you would do that is, well, it's a multi-part thing. For example, you would, for example, at first replace each of the occurrences of some string, probably with a number. And what you could do there is, well, you could have your scanner work for you appropriately to take care of that. Yeah, for example, if you have an input that has a lot of different strings, what you would do is you would do same numbers for the same lexical patterns. So for if you have Pete, then this is your first encountered string. You would give it a 0. For Piper, we'd give it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. And as soon as you hit Peter a second time, you will reuse your old number, which is 0. Piper would be 1 picked, and so on. So that is the first way of kind of normalizing your variable name. So we would introduce codes for your variable names. How you could achieve that is, well, you would have to map your string somehow to an integer. How could you do that? Well, that's with a data structure where you could where you would compute from a string its number, and if it doesn't have a number yet, you would give it a new number. So what you would keep track of is the actual count of different strings that you have accessed so far, and you would always increase it in case you have not yet seen your string yet. So you would have to keep track of some data structure that would associate strings with either a number or not yet seen. So it would yield an undefined. And in case that it has not yet seen the string, we would then have an operation that adds a mapping from the string to a number. And in case it has already seen the whole thing, we would just return the number that is associated with the whole thing. How can you implement that? There are several possibilities. That's diving a little bit into efficient algorithms here. So, we have, for example, the choice to do it with lists of pairs. This has an easy insert, but a quite expensive lookup, so that's something that we don't want to use. If we want to optimize a little bit, trees are always a nice idea, so what about balanced trees? Well, we have a logarithmic access for that, but that's something that in practice turns out to be not as efficient as hash tables, because with hash tables you will have, on average, an excess of just constant length if you do it in an intelligent way. And the intelligent thing that you need is you need to compute integers from strings in a somewhat intelligent manner, which is also computationally cheap. So what is choices that we have here? Well, we need to choose some kind of hash function. I don't know how you would compute hashes of strings, but the most precise way to come up with a number characterizing a string is probably to treat the different characters of a string as a kind of a very complicated system of numbering with where each of the string position is actually a position in your number, and you would try to compute the decimal version of the number that you see here as a string. And how you would do that is sketched here in your in the second choice for a hash function. The idea would be to compute the sum of a few products, and each of the products consists in the actual characters coding as a number multiplied with a number that represents the position of the character in the string. And if you choose p as the number of all the characters that you have the choice from for your string, and I as the actual position of the current character in the string, you can kind of encode a number that exactly represents your string in a numerical fashion. And if you want to fit it in some kind of array, well, you will have to work with a prime number at some times. Well, in this case, well, I think it's... in this case, it does it the other way around. But anyway, you have boundaries on how much how much space to store you have for all your different entries of your hash table, and well, you will choose the hash function to have an according modular value here. So that everything will fit into your hash table. Well, that is something that includes a lot of computation. There's for each of the characters in your string, you have one addition and one multiplication. So that's what you see over here, which is something which is quite expensive, especially considering that as your strings grow, then also the value that you accumulate during the computation grows quite a lot. You can say, well, as we are only interested in some integer that is related to our string, we can compute with machine integers, and we can just accept anything that comes out from that. But even though it's still a lot of additions and multiplications that you can do, so there's ways to only approximately represent strings as numbers, and there's certain heuristics. For example, you could take the first and last character of a string and do just the sum, and this would already suffice you as your representation of your string as a number. But yeah, that highly depends on the way that users specify their identifiers. And yeah, if you have a lot of variables that, for example, in the LLVM intermediate representation, you have a lot of variables that start with the same letter and end with just a number. So essentially, you will end up with just differentiating 10 different variable names from each other, and well, that's probably not what you would have had in mind. So anyway, it's a little bit depending on what you have as input for your hash function, but I'm sure with the choices that you have seen here, you'll be able to find your own hash function that is appropriate for your needs. And apart from that, we have the usual design for our hash table. So we will have a maximum number of entries, many slots where we can store our key value pairs. And they are actually stored in a kind of linear list. So when we have two colliding hash values, we will just run through the list and do exact comparisons of our hash keys. Well, anyways, that is just a small repetition of what hash functions and hash tables are all about. You need them in order to implement the symbol tables. What is a symbol table? These are data structures that we want to use for associating variables with their identity. And where will we actually use them? Well, what we will do is we will traverse the syntax tree in some suitable sequence, which is probably related to the program order. So such an L attribution is probably something which is quite appropriate for visiting the syntax tree. And what we will keep track of is all the declarations that we see. And as soon as we reach the use of any of these identifiers, what we'll do is we will take just the last definition that we have encountered during our run through the program so far and store it as the one that is to be connected with our occurrence of an identifier. Yeah, so how can we perform that? Well, we will probably have our symbol table mapping each identifier to a stack of scopes, because each time that we have opening and closing brackets in our programs, well, in the C-like programs, we will have opened a new scope. And during this scope, we can encounter new declarations of variables, but as soon as we leave them, we will probably have to resort to the old declaration. So we will have to somehow still keep the old declarations in some place. So what we will do is we will manage a stack, and as soon as a new scope is opening, we push something on the stack, and as soon as the scope is closed, we will pop everything away and continue with just what has been below that part of the just been below so far in the stack. Okay. Yeah. In case that we find the usage of such a variable, we will just look into the stack that we stored for this identifier and look for the first declaration that we find, and in case that there's none that we find, then we have found an error in the program because there's a use of a variable which has not been declared so far. So let's have a look at an example. We will run through the program from the beginning and have a look at what our algorithm would do. I have kept kind of symbolic characterizations of all the places where we have had declarations. So when we talk about declaration V, we will talk about the declaration for A at this point. When we will talk about declaration X, then we will have the declaration for A at that point. So that's the meaning of these letters, so to say. So what we will do is we will, well, when we run through the definition use analysis of our program, we will enter the scope, and we will at first pass a chain of declarations, and we will enter for A, we will have found a declaration called V. For B, we will have found a declaration called W. Okay, so we have hit two declarations. So we will then continue. We reach now usage of a variable, which is the usage of B. So what we will do in our algorithm is, what will we do? Well, we will in this case have to look up in the A section of our symbol table for which declaration is belonging to B, in the B section, sorry. So we will look up in B for the first declaration that we find for B, and we will know that B will be declared in declaration W. Okay, so we go on further. So the next thing that we hit is this identifier B. For this one, what we will do? Well, we will once again look up our declarations, so we will find another W as declaration for this one. Okay. So now we will enter a new block, which is a new scope for us. So we will kind of mark this one in our stacks. And what we have here is now we will have a new declaration here for A. So we will look into our A and have a look at whether there is already an A defined here in our actual scope. Is not, so that's fine. We will enter X. Then we will have we will progress on to to C. C is a new declaration. So we check whether there is already a declaration for C in this scope. It's not, so we'll enter Y. And we will go on. There's a usage of A, so we will have to check A. Well, for A we find X, so we will annotate X as the definition here. Note that we had already another definition for A, but this one is deeper down in the stack, so that is something that we won't use for that. Yeah, later on, what will be there? There's another A, so we will also annotate it with X. There's C. For C, now we will have Y, so that's fine. Now, the first thing that is more exciting is now B. For B, we don't have an entry in the actual scope, so we'll have to traverse to the scope above. So we will take W, so W is the scope to go here. So, I think probably what I was supposed to do here was to kind of continue in our new scope with the space that we had here for symbol tables, but you saw me already using kind of a trick for implementing this scope opening and closing, because what you would do now at this position here that we have reached, which is this one, is that we encounter a closing a closing scope. So normally we would have a problem here because we would have to rearrange something in our tables. What I have done here is I have put little markers on the stack for each of the identifiers, which would mark the beginning of a new scope. And I put the marker on, not keeping any attention to whether there has been a declaration on there or not. And I just put a marker on there. So what I can do now is that I can remove everything that is on top of the stack until I reach the next new scope value, and even put that away and have the original state of my symbol table once again. So now I can have a clean restart. I will open a new. No, I have to. I will open a new scope here, which will consist in then new scope symbols everywhere. And now I can have a new declaration. So this is this one here. So this will declare Z to be resolved to the set declaration. Now I can analyze my declaration uses once again. This time the uses, and yeah, I will go further on. A will be resolved to, well, it will be V. C will be resolved to this time Z and not Y as it has been before. Then there's once again Z, and then there's B, which is W once again. And yeah, what also differs is of course now the resolution of A, which is now mapped to the declaration from here instead of the declaration from here. But that's only because I managed my symbol table in a more intelligent way. Now that I've reached the end of my scope with this one, I can do once again my trick here by removing the entries up till the last usage of new scope symbol, and then try to resolve A and B, and I will come up with just V and W for these ones. So that is how you could, for example, realize such a symbol table. Yeah, here you see intermediate states of the symbol table. This was the non-intelligent version that I actually found so stupid that I didn't perform it. But anyway, what you would come up with would be the links or the references from each of the occurrence of the identifiers to their respective declarations. So this is what the symbol table analysis would actually do, and this is something which you could do with such an L attributation. The idea would be that as a type for the attribute, you would choose the symbol table, and if you implement the symbol table in an intelligent way, what you can do is you can use copy on write data structures, and when you do that, you can just give or use the hash table of your parent as a hash table in your child of the attribute tree. And as soon as you enter something new, the old thing would still remain the same, and you could go on with just a modified entry into your symbol table thing that would incorporate your changes. So if you do your compiler in a functional language, that is something that is achieved by a lot of the data structures that you get in functional languages, where you have this copy on write behavior. And with this, you can get the behavior that as soon as you have finished working with your subtree, you can continue with evaluating the second subtree of your subtree, but you will have nothing of your entries overwritten. Will still be the same state as it has been when you started evaluating the subtree. So that is something which is quite handy for our symbol table analysis. So I think this is telling you about the trick that I have already used on the slides before. What you could also do is, if you are in a procedural or object-oriented language, is that instead of using a hash table where all the values are stacks, what you also could do would be just keeping a stack of hash tables where you only keep the changes that you, well, all the new declarations that are done within your scope in the top of the stack. And if you have to look for the declaration of a certain used identifier, you would have to go through the stack back to the bottom. So that is also a valid implementation for the whole thing. But what you will have, what you will need in any way is some kind of hash table and some kind of stack involved. Or, well, these copy-on-write data structures, that also works. But in this case, you do this stack implicitly by having a recursive function. So, yeah, stack is involved in any way. Okay. So, there's a few special cases that are coming into play when you try to do this declaration use analysis on practical code, but I think we have already progressed quite far in our topic, so we should probably close for today and continue next time. So thank you for your attention and goodbye.